You're listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental.
TMZ, oh my goodness.
I mean, what are we doing here?
I think he's the philosopher of football.
It's great that everyone can give their opinion.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Find me. Find me. I don't care anymore. So drain my bank account.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
From New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time, driven by Continental from the AT&T MLS Studios in Midtown Manhattan. I am Andrew Wiebe with my partners in soccer, Matt Doyle, Bobby Warshaw. Big show for you guys. Let's get right into it. And
I want you to know,
couldn't help myself.
I'm preparing to challenge you to a drum off on the New York, New York.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What's a drum
off?
What does that even mean? This has been Bear, by the way.
You know what a drum off is?
I don't.
You've seen the movie Drumline?
I have seen the Drumline movie.
If you want to move up in ranks,
you have to challenge 1v1.
Right now, you're first string on New York, New York.
I am.
Mm-hmm. I'm just saying, I'm coming.
Okay.
Well, neither of you two are from New York, just for the record. I'm just going to point that out.
That has nothing to do with being able to say from New York, New York.
But I have the accent.
That's the sort of take that got you relegated. In this, look, we have a great show coming for you. It is a truncated show because of Memorial Day. That's the way things work. It is late on Sunday night right now. We have back from the dead, let's say. The Brown Liquor Special has returned. We've finished Match Day Central, which I hope you watch. You can watch it on demand at any time, including on Pluto TV. But we have about, I'm calculating here, 16 minutes to talk MLS Week 13 because we have an incredible interview for you with Tony Meola. He is a National Soccer Hall of Famer. The class of 2019 is in. Just one player, Abby Wambach. She was a first ballot player from the moment she retired and became eligible. Sunil Gulati already in. I will save my rant about the National Soccer Hall of Fame voting process, eligibility process, why, oh, why there are not more deserving players who get inducted every year. We'll be back to that, but feel free to send your mail, 401-206-0MLS, extratime@mlssoccer.com. We're keeping it simple today, guys. Your winners from Week 13, Chris Wondolowski got two more goals and a win on the road in Toronto. Wando doesn't stop scoring. He's at 150. The Portland Timbers are done with their road travels. They won again. They beat the Philadelphia Union. Sporting KC won for the first time since March 30th. So that's pretty good for them. That might qualify them as winners. I guess we'll start with you, Doyle. Who's your winner? Who's on top from this heap?
Honestly, the team that we just saw win a game, the final game of the weekend, San Jose Earthquakes. I think we all kind of expect this to come back down to earth at some point. They were so bad in March, but they've been so good since. They're 5-2-2. They came back from 1-0 down. They won 2-1 at Toronto. Now, granted, Toronto elected not to play defense against Chris Wondolowski.
That seems
bad
like a
decision.
Bad, seems like a very bad idea.
Bad idea.
Not even play defense. Just acknowledge Wando's presence in the
team. Does Wando have a vanishing cloak of
some
kind?
No, I'm telling you, he's a Jedi Knight.
I don't understand. Chris Mavinga had no idea he was
there. He has Jedi powers, and he uses mind tricks to make defenders forget that he exists.
If we're being honest, the vanishing cloak is Harry Potter and not Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
So
right, this is a mixed metaphor.
No, it was. Don't mix
them. I'm not a Harry Potter person. I couldn't remember what the vanishing thing was called. So, but let's just keep on going.
I don't think anybody's surprised that Bobby is a big Harry Potter guy. Big
Harry Potter guy.
No, the Quakes are good. I did not see it coming. Like they have players on the team that I like. They have some talent. I did not see 5-2-2 over the last 9. A lot of those have been on the road. A lot of those have been against good teams. Especially after what did they lose? 172-1 against LAFC. Like they just got played off the field in the most embarrassing way. Like after that, I was like, the Quakes are going to end up being the worst team in MLS history, and they're so far from that.
That's how quickly MLS can turn you on your head. 4 straight losses to start the season for the Quakes. Chris Wondolowski starts scoring. They start figuring out Mateus Almeida's system, and here they are on the brink of the playoffs in the stacked Western Conference, which, by the way, are the ultimate winners from this week, because against the East, they had 6 wins and 1 draw. In the last 13 games, the East hasn't won a single game against the Western Conference. Not one. They've only drawn 2. That's it.
Well, total for the season, it's West 31, East 22. So this weekend kind of put them way above them where we all, from just like not looking at the numbers, you would think the West would be at, like way higher coming into the weekend, having more wins. But
still, double digit weekend wins. Still a big gap.
Ben, you got to stay on brand. What's the expected wins?
Good question. That's a good question.
I don't know.
It's a Monday morning question. Not a Sunday night.
Not Memorial Day Monday, though. Maybe a Tuesday morning question. Bobby, what's your winner?
I don't know how you guys give any winner except the Portland Timbers right now. Like, have you seen what they've been doing? Have you seen Brian Fernandez? Have you seen the fact that 17...
I get that you're hyped on Brian Fernandez, but, like, are they going to... Philly gave them two goals. Philly just gave them two goals. Is that going to happen every week?
Maybe.
Okay.
You got Brian Fernandez on your team. You seen this guy?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, he is, as Steve Clark said, a junkyard dog. He wants the ball, and he wants to put it in the back of the net, and he's not particularly pretty with the way he does it, though I think he can be. We maybe just haven't seen that yet. But he is the, like, he's the blunt instrument right now for Giovanni Savarese. He just...
But...
Throw him into goal-scoring opportunities and see what happens.
You guys are making him sound like he's a Wando with a little extra kick. I mean, this guy can ball too, right? He's faster than most defenders. He's got a little bit of skill. I'm not going to say he's the next Jovinko, but this Portland Timbers team has, what, 17 of the next 22 games at home? And they're already within striking distance of the playoffs, and now they add one of the most expensive players in league history? I don't know how there's any winner this week except the Portland Timbers finishing up their 12-game road stretch to start the year.
They didn't need him to be more than that, though, right? They needed him to be a stretch-the-field guy who's efficient in the final third and ruthless.
For sure they did. And he's
things,
like three yeah. times more than that.
It's beautiful. Portland Timbers, they're still below the playoff line.
You're making... That's You're all in, huh?
Yeah. I mean, to me, the second goal, anybody would have scored that one.
Right.
First goal, he got himself in a good spot.
Yep.
But the second, if you only watch the last part,
could have scored at least one of those goals.
If you only watch what happened, but if you rewind 5 seconds, he left Austin Trusty in the dust.
Yeah, he killed him.
He almost broke Austin Trusty, who is one of the best 1v1 defenders in MLS right now. He almost broke his ankles.
He's not the fastest 1v1.
I do wonder whether Brian Fernandez is going to be more of a Joseph Martinez type, like a true center forward who's always running off the back shoulder, always splitting the two center backs, or if he's going to be like a Diego Rossi goal-scoring wing. Like, Diego Rossi's not even a goal-scoring winger. He's a wide forward. You know, like, whether he's going to be that type of guy. But Bobby's right. He's really, really good. I'm just surprised to see Bobby so all in. So the last player Bobby was this all in on this quickly was Jack Price. It was Jack Price.
Oh, God. Beautiful.
I'll tell you what.
He was literally lining it up for about 30 seconds.
But honestly, who would win in a cage match between Jack Price and Jack McInerney? That's the question Doyle needs to ask himself.
Wow, that's a different Sunday night podcast. We don't have enough time to cover that.
Where's Bobby going?
Are we going to put Jay Chapman in this?
I don't understand.
Or Chris,
these are your former,
or Chris Clute.
Yeah, Chris Clute.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, your former Flames.
Devin Sandoval might have a chance.
Okay, your former Flames. We should
I
will.
Chris Clute, by the way, not Chris Clute.
So if we're talking, this is kind of a theme right now with winners. We sometimes say, class or trash. It was a lot of teams that went from trash to class because the Timbers, 5 losses in their first 6. They only have 4 wins on the season, but that matches the amount of road wins they had all of last season. They're going to be okay. It's going to be fine. That new stadium is incredible as well. The additions are beautiful. Your winner from week 13, what do you got?
I'm going to go with Real Salt Lake.
Mm.
They've been very Jekyll and Hyde over the past,
18 months?
3 years, let's go with. About
decade.
Yeah, decade. Yeah, whatever you want to call it. They're playing really well right now. They won against Atlanta.
Three straight wins and 5 of 7.
Yes. Thanks a lot to Bofo Saucedo and then of course Jefferson Savarino with that amazing goal, mm-hmm. which Ramsey Sandoval was calling for, which I kind of liked that. That was pretty good. I like that. Yeah, but anyways, they have to keep pace in the West because you're looking at a Timbers team who's going to claim one of those spots, looks like, considering they're basically at the playoff line and they have all those home games left. So, they have to keep pace. They got that home win that they needed against a really good opponent. So they're keeping pace in that, and that's exactly what they needed to do. And they're doing it with Bofo Saucedo. Kyle Beckerman's been injured. Everton Luiz has been injured. Sam Johnson's been in and out of the lineup. So they're doing it not really at their full strength.
Here's my question for you three. You were to start a team right now. and you have to factor in both current talent and future transfer. Do you pick A, Diego Rossi, door number two, Albert Elise, or door number three, Jefferson Savarino?
Oh,
Savarino's easily three.
Albert Elise, easily number one. Albert Elise can be a number one option on a really good team, which we've seen back in 2017 and 2018 as this team won a freaking trophy. Diego Rossi's not there yet. I don't think Savarino's the exact same guy he was when he came into the league 2 years ago.
Yep. So, I mean, Savarino's easily number three. I mean, just because you're looking at Albert Elise is really good. He's the best player, one of the best players in the league right now, and you can probably sell him for eight figures.
Yeah.
Pretty soon. Diego Rossi's probably in that range, maybe a little bit less. He's also producing
Now. Who goes for
Jefferson
the most?
Jefferson Savarino, he could be in this league for a while. I mean, producing for you for a while, which is great, but you're not going to get that huge transfer fee.
Rossi will go for the most because he's Uruguayan, and there's less of a stigma about buying a Uruguayan attacker,
especially
than
if he plays
Venezuelan
plays well in Copa America or in World Cup qualifying. The moment he does that, that will launch his value straight up. The real winners, though, as it is with every week, RLAFC. I'm not going to take the easy way out. Good Lord, Carlos Vela, 15 goals, 4-2. They just run everybody. It's an incredible thing. I'm going with the Colorado Rapids. You know what? You haven't been winners much on Extra Time. You've mostly been losers, and we have. I'm not going to say gleefully in any way because I don't enjoy suffering or pain. And there's been a lot of it to start.
It's my
thing. I did enjoy some of the like media back and forth that happened around the Colorado Rapids. But you know what? It doesn't matter that the Crew have lost 8 of 9. It doesn't matter that this was maybe not the best defensive performance yet again from the Rapids. It just matters that they're getting wins because the first 2.5 months of this season were so painful for them. We talked about it on Matchday Central. Hey, this game's easy. Just don't make catastrophic mistakes. Well, they went out and made like 3 to 4, maybe 5 every single game. And now they're making 2 and they're finding a way to get the job done. And Nicholas Mosqueda even is showing his class, which they said he's our 10. We'll see what happens. And they did see what happens.
He's not.
But he showed his class. Yeah. He had his opportunity. He scored the goal. There's something at least to it. They had a big crowd. They had a nice moment. It's what they needed. Blessings to everyone.
That crowd. I mean, that crowd looked lit.
Hey, lit. Did.
Can I use that word?
You can't. No, that's a tough move for you. Any other winners that we can quickly collect before we get to Tony Miola, which is an amazing interview, by the way, and we'll have Bobby give you.
The Vancouver Whitecaps. They had a 6-pointer at home against FC Dallas, and granted, Dallas are hurt and they're without guys who are on international duty, and they've been sinking in the standings. This is a game that the Caps could have dropped the result here. It could have been easily a 1-1 or 2-2 tie. But they got guys this offseason, Ali Adnan, Freddie Montero. Was it Venuto?
Venuto.
Lucas Venuto, who scored the goal. Like, these guys are supposed to be difference makers in the final third. They have not been for most of the year, and they were in this game. And this is the type of win that maybe gets you over the playoff line and into the playoffs. So they needed it badly, and they got it. And they're much better now than they were a month and a half ago.
I thought it was interesting what you were saying, Ben, about Real Salt Lake and knowing they have to keep pace because there's these teams behind them. It's not just the Timbers. Sporting KC are back there. They won 3-2 against Seattle. Johnny Russell with the hat trick. They're in 11th. They could easily climb. Portland Timbers are there. Vancouver Whitecaps are there on 17. San Jose are there on 17. And, of course, the Rapids are at the bottom. I don't think anybody realistically expects them to make a playoff run.
I mean, Bobby picked them to make
a playoff. He did. So did David.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think you're looking at a ton of teams. Maybe the Rapids are the only team out. But you look at, I mean, yes, the Caps had a great week.
Tranquilo, Ben.
Yeah, the Caps had a great week, but they also played more games than anybody else in the West. Their points per game is not as high as some of the other teams. So I think they have a lot of room here to gain on these other teams.
Would you guarantee, and I'm just workshopping this, the Rapids to miss the playoffs?
Yeah, they're done.
Would you make that guarantee? Just done. Speak the words.
Say the
please.
Words. I guarantee.
That's like never how it went.
I
guarantee the Rapids will not make the playoffs.
Okay. Woo! There it is. Rapids are going, baby. Rapids are going to push above the line.
Special episode, folks.
Week 13, Matchday Central, probably your best place to get the long and the short of everything.
Given your track record, Ben, like that basically means the Rapids are going to make the playoffs.
We suckered you right.
That would be an incredible run.
It would.
It would be.
It really would.
It would be way more incredible than the Sounders in 2016.
I believe in Kai.
Kai, good player.
I mean,
I just want to say this. I want to say this. The Columbus Crew have lost 8 of 9. Is that number right, Andrew?
That is correct. That's correct.
Everyone at this table right now, in this moment, can agree if the Crew make the playoffs.
They do not.
If the Crew make the playoffs, Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
Then what?
I'm very confused about this line you're dropping right now. The Crew made the playoffs, then what?
David Akam is MVP.
I should have known. I was like, where is he going with this? What is wrong with this person? Like, how could he? He's leading us down a blind alley, and then on the other side, the shining light.
Are you moving to Nashville next year, by the way?
That's great. That's good stuff.
Just to be the personal cheerleader for David Akam.
Just the pilgrimage.
Starting on the new team in MLS. And you're going to, I mean, if there's ever going to be an expansion team MVP, we know it's going to be David Kahn. So you can go ahead and do that. You can guarantee that right now if you want.
I don't think so. No? I did catch somebody else recently looking at Nashville real estate prices. I won't say who. We're going to get out of here. It is Memorial Day weekend. I hope that you're enjoying today, this Monday, with your family and friends. Before we do, though.
Is Memorial Day in Canada as well?
I don't know.
I think it's just Monday.
Yeah, I hope you're having a great Monday.
That's
though,
why I'm
winning
the Montreal.
I mean, they're all for the Raptors.
Yeah,
you know? They've had a great weekend.
Yeah, it's been a great time. Before we get out of here, Bobby, I'd like you to do the honors of helping us sell people on this Tony Meola interview, which I don't think should be difficult. He's a National Soccer Hall of Famer. He's an absolute legend. His career came in such an interesting time in U.S. soccer between U-20 World Cups and World Cups in 90 and 94 and then 2002 and his background in New Jersey and all the guys he came up with. Give us the good sell here.
The most basic thing you can say, and you already alluded to it, he has wild stories, right? To talk about Tab Ramos as a high schooler, to talk about what it was like to prepare for the earliest World Cups in 1990, 1994 for the U.S., but more importantly, he tells them in an interesting way. He's a very good storyteller. He's somebody with something interesting to say, and he says it very well. Andrew, I would call this probably the most engaged I've ever been with a athlete interview.
He was nodding his head the whole time. If Carlos Ruiz, Pescadito, is tier one extra time interviews, not sure that will ever be topped, then this is a clear tier two. So if Carlos Ruiz is LAFC, this is like, I don't know, maybe it's like
Colorado
Union,
Rapids.
It's like what? Seattle, yeah. You know, there's not a great tier two in MLS right now. It's like LAFC and then rotating cast, but Tony's above all them. Take a listen. Enjoy your Memorial Day or your Monday in Canada. We will be back on Thursday.
Hawaii Day, I think they
call. See you then. This is also a Callum Malice jersey. I just want everyone out there to know that. If you're not watching on YouTube, you don't know that Ben Bear is bringing the heat on this show. Ben, thank you. Matt, Bobby, thanks for sticking around. Here's Tony Meola. We'll see you on Thursday. All right, we're gathered for a new series, I guess, about the National Soccer Hall of Fame, where we bring in Hall of Famers or call them up or get to them however we can. And the first on the list, in New Jersey, but not for long, was Tony Meola. You know him, I mean, you know him so well from so many different places, from youth national teams to Virginia, where you were winning trophies, to MLS, to indoor soccer, to the national team, to the 94 World Cup, and the 90 World Cup, and the 2002 World Cup, and then as a coach in ASL, and now you hear him all the time on SiriusXM. Tony, what's up, man?
I'm doing good. You just wanted me to, you said you could have done a phoner, huh? You wanted to see me drive in an hour and a half of traffic.
Well, we wanted to see you. We could have done a phoner, but no, it's not great. As good.
We
as...
wanted to convince people that someone would actually come in and talk
right.
to
well,
us.
Well, there you go.
You were the pilot.
First one.
Once Tony comes in, nobody can say no. Hey, Tony Meola came. Get in your car. Get on a plane. Come our way.
Use it if it helps.
So I just want to talk to you about your career and about U.S. soccer because you kind of bridged all these different eras and different times, and you have a fascinating career, not just on the field, but also off the field. I kind of think of you as a Renaissance man in the sense that you've done a lot of things that weren't quote-unquote traditional. You went and tried to kick for the Jets. You went off-Broadway after the World Cup, I think, to go act. You were drafted as a baseball player by the Yankees. I mean, your life, not just your career, your life is so rich, but I want to start where it began because for so many, it began in Kearney and in New Jersey of your generation.
That's Kearney.
Let's get that one right.
If I'm being honest, he said it pre-show and he said it wrong, and I was so ready for him to do it wrong on
why,
the show.
Why would you not save me?
For this
I'm
moment.
I'm not a good wingman.
I'm a sound it out guy. Now I'm blushing.
No, that's okay. We've been called worse. Don't worry. We've been called a lot worse than that.
It's not just you, though. It's so many guys that were part of that you know, that generation of U.S. soccer that came out of there. So I want to understand what it was like to grow up there, how so many players could come out of one place and go so far in this game.
Yeah, you know, where we grew up, soccer was the cool thing to do. I didn't really know anything. I grew up in that town, right? It was everything we knew, and we were all first generation. Majority of them were first generation from Scotland or England. Myself and my best friend, our parents immigrated from Italy, so we were two outcasts really for a little while. And we didn't know that the rest of the country didn't play soccer. We didn't know that it, you know, football and basketball and baseball were prominent at all these high schools, because we had for years won state championships. And from the time we were 6 years old and starting to kick a ball, our high school coach was watching games all the time, and he knew all the players in town. And the only thing you ever wanted to do was put on a state championship high school jacket. Like, that's all we knew, right? And I happened to fall in love with other sports at a young age, so I did some other things. But goal number one was to play varsity soccer in high school. I know things are a little bit different now, and it's evolved into something you know, that doesn't necessarily involve varsity soccer anymore for a lot of kids. But that's all you wanted to do. So when I grew up and I heard the names John Harkes and Tab Ramos move from Uruguay to our town, and immediately we took a trip to Bermuda with our youth club team to go play, and got to see him play like he was in America at that point for like 2 weeks. You know, we that's all we dreamed about all day. And I come to realize now that that's not exactly how it was in the rest of the country.
What, how competitive was it as a group? Like, how competitive was it when you see Tab Ramos come and John Harkes is one of the best players in the country, and yourself, and just that group training every single day and just playing pickup?
Yeah, and you've got other guys. I mean, if you go to Kearney and ask from sort of just that era alone who the best player was, it's Billy Galka, right? And Billy Galka is a name that when you watch this new movie that came out about Soccer Town USA, I'm sure you're going to hear that name a lot. He's now the high school coach at Kearney High School.
Wow.
And when everyone says, who's the best player ever to come out, he went to the University of Connecticut and played there. Just, you know, didn't have the same pathway maybe that some of us did. But you think of the Jerry McEwens, who started PDA. You think of Rob McCourt, who's the head coach at Monmouth right now. Mike O'Neill, who's the head women's coach at Rutgers right now. These are guys that were all first-team All-State, went to ODU, went to, you know, place, I mean, some of the top schools in the country. There were a lot of players that came out of that area. How did we do it? I have no idea, right? Because John Harkes' dad was our coach. You know, Rob Chesney, who's now the athletic director at Montclair State University, who was the head soccer coach there, his dad was a coach. He was a mailman, you know, and they just, I think they just made it simple for us. They said, you know what, here's a ball. Right, and go out and enjoy yourself, and go out and play. And I remember, it's funny because I heard Bob Bradley say this years down the road when he was talking about. I actually coached his nephews, and I heard him talk about this. And I learned from Rob Chesney, who the guy was a mailman, right? And I learned, he said, the best way to figure out if you're a defender, if you're a forward, if you're a goalkeeper, is go roll the ball out and see where everyone migrates. You know, defenders will go back here and forwards will go here. And it's kind of how I took it. I heard Bob Bradley talk about this years and years down the road. I'd learned this down the road. So they were very simple in the way that they approached the game. But the one thing they were very concerned about was winning and losing. Like, when you were in Kearney, you didn't lose games. You did not make it to a state championship. At the club level, we played for Thistle FC. You did not make a state cup. So we learned some of those lessons really young.
What did you think when you saw Tab Ramos for the first time?
You know, the same player that people saw in Spain and Mexico and Major League Soccer and the national team, we saw it when. So that trip, I was 10 years old. He was 12 years old. And we went down to Bermuda, and it was like, by the time the trip was over, we played like every other date. So we played like five or six games. And, you know, the younger team would play first. And then we had three age groups. So the youngest played first and all the way to the oldest. By the time we were halfway through the trip, it was like the entire village in Bermuda was going to watch Tab play. And that's how amazing he was. And I still say, and everyone knows he's my friend. So full disclosure, right? I mean, I still don't think we've ever produced a player like Tab Ramos. And you talk to national team players, and we just did this 94 reunion a couple weeks ago, and everyone said the same thing, that we still have never seen a player like him.
If he doesn't get knocked out in 94, do you think you guys win that game?
Well, if you remember,
sorry not to jump on.
No. The we hung in there as long as we could, right? And he's the one guy that we missed, because we had one guy in that group. John Harkes, remember, was suspended for that game because he got the yellow card standing in the wall against Romania just before that. He was the one guy that could break you down. And if you remember the first 2 minutes of that game, we had two opportunities where we thought, a foot from the goal, how we didn't score a goal against Brazil, you know, all created by him. And he was, you know, he playing a man up, he would have been the one guy in the field that you wanted, and we missed.
So they roll the ball out, and you go to goalkeeper. You were also a forward. How did this kind of come together for you, and you go down the path that you went?
Pretty simple. The coach said, the shortest, fattest guy, you're over there. You're at the end over there. No science to it, really. You know, no, but yeah, I loved it. It was one of those things. I jumped in goal for the first time, and that was what I loved to do. Eventually, I learned when I became a pro that I was actually supposed to be a center forward, but no one believed me. You know, I tried to convince Bob Gansler to do it, and I did it in an all-star game. I don't know if you guys even know that. I played in an MLS all-star game as a forward. Whichever year, so that would have been 2000. I think the All-Star game was in Columbus.
Epic year for you, 2000.
Yeah, it was.
Well, what a year.
Good one. Yeah. Can we relive that one?
We will later. Yeah, we will later.
Yeah, so, once I got in, that was it. I loved being dirty, and I loved, you know, my mother screaming about how, you know, why do you have to dive in the mud? The grass is over there, you know? Like, the whole thing was fun to me.
It's always been interesting to me, though, for goalkeepers. To me, it's like it's a different sport. You're doing something else. Do you enjoy the tactics and the movement of field players, even though you weren't participating in it?
Well, I personally think that my biggest strength in my game was organizing, right? And I think it's part of the reason why I played as long as I did, and I played till I was almost 40, because managers thought that I could, and if it wasn't for the 90 minutes, it was probably equally as important throughout the week, because you're hearing a voice, you're organizing, you're another set of sort of eyeballs for the coach, where maybe he doesn't have to worry about defensively. You know, we didn't do a lot outside of you know, Bob Gansler, I'm trying to think, at least in the league. And when I played in England, everything was a back four, right? Mm-hmm. And whether you had two guys in front of him or one guy, that was the real difference, right? And so there wasn't a lot of organization. I loved when we went to a back three in 2000 and we won the championship in Kansas City, because I felt like I was learning something new, you know, in some similarities in what you do. But the way Bob Gansler wanted it interpreted, we did some things that sometimes looked like a back four, sometimes looked like a three, a five. I was learning something new. And at that point, I think I was 30 or 31 in my career, so it was pretty cool to sort of put that in you know, your bag for the rest of your life.
You had a choice to make coming out of high school. You chose goalkeeper. You were incredible at it. I mean, you said it. You guys just won, and you won individually as well. You were also a baseball player, and you got drafted by the Yankees. Was there ever any thought as to what you were going to do? Ever think that maybe I could have gone and played baseball? You went to Virginia with Bruce Arena. But do you ever think about that moment and think, what if?
Well, I played baseball in college. Remember, yeah, back then, I ended up at third base. I started as a center fielder because I used to be able to run, right? I was fast back in high school. The choice wasn't made until we played and qualified in Trinidad for the World Cup. That's when I finally said, that's it for baseball for me. Because I'd already played. Remember, I played baseball in college before I played soccer, because that freshman year of college, Jeff Agus and I played in the Under-20 World Cup, so we had to redshirt. So my first steps on campus were in January, which started baseball season. But the only way I could do it back then, and again, it's one of those things, you're really naive, you don't know any different. There was the only way I could go to school for free. You know, it was half my scholarship was baseball, half of it was soccer. And the only way my parents could ever send me to school was to take a full scholarship. And I had full dreams of going to Duke university. I can't stand Duke right now, right? I hate him. Right? You go to Virginia, you hate Duke, right? But and John, because I was going to follow John Harkes, he was 2 years ahead of me. And for years, John kept saying all through high school, I'm going to Duke, I'm going to Duke, I'm going to Duke. And then one day he came back from his trip to Virginia. He's like, I'm going to Virginia. I call my mom, she's like, I'm going to Virginia. You know, it's like, well, where's Virginia? You know, I'm just figuring out where Duke is. I said, we don't have to go as far anymore, you know. But that's kind of how it all happened. And, you know, I loved playing both sports. I played basketball, and I still think basketball was probably the biggest benefit. I tell all the young goalkeepers that I coach, if you play basketball, you're gonna. There's a huge advantage in there. And I still think that's the one sport that sort of helped me the most in my game.
That's footwork that you're talking about. The footwork, the reaction.
Going up in traffic, gathering a ball, because I still think crosses was one of the big parts of my game. We don't see a lot of it now because the balls have changed. The way guys whip balls in the box is completely different. The number of players that are in the box is completely different. So we don't see a lot of it now. You watch European games, if you see a goalkeeper take two crosses in a game, that's a lot. And, you know, so we don't see a lot of it anymore just because the evolution of the game. But yeah, basketball helped me in that area for sure.
Bruce Arena, 30 years ago, what was it like? What was he like? How much has he changed? Yeah, that's what I figured. Not a lot.
Zero.
Yeah.
Yeah, he came with Dennis Womack, who was the baseball coach, to our house and sat down with my family, had dinner, and that's when they gave us the proposal. And my father, you know, my father's old school, you know, and I tell this story all the time. It's kind of funny. He had a list. We had a dial phone, you know, you pick up the phone. So for me to call a coach was painful, you know, like, so he had a list, and he would, every time a college coach would call, he'd say, where are you from and how much is the offer? My father didn't speak English very well, so it was very limited. And I can remember Coach Berticelli calling. He was at Old Dominion at the time, and I met him at a banquet down the road, and he tells the story, used to tell the story all the time. He's passed now. So he said, I called the Miola's house, and Mr. Miola picked up, and he said, where are you from? You know, and he said, Old Dominion. He said, how much is your offer? He said, 80%. He said, call me back when you got 100%. He hung up the phone. You know, it's kind of how it worked back then.
Yeah,
they called.
Tax.
Yeah, and that was it. My father, he only had like three sentences that he could say at the time, so he was learning along the way. And you know, they sat down, Bruce sat down and laid it on the table. And he did say the one thing that he said to me that stuck with me there is that we're going to win a national championship. That's what he told me. And he was the only guy to say that we're going to win a national championship. And I was sold at that point. You know, John was going there already. And I said, you know, I want to win a national championship. I want to play like the top teams. And at that time, the ACC was pretty much it. UCLA was good. UNLV was very good. And SMU were very good. But outside of the ACC, you didn't want to go anywhere. So I was sold.
When you talk about your father, he played a little pro in Italy. Was that a big part of you playing? Did you play with him? Did you compete against him? Did he like that you were a goalkeeper?
He's the first one I kicked the soccer ball with, you know, in the driveway, and he didn't have a very long career. Played in a youth club in Avellino and had aspirations of being a pro. So my career, I was really fortunate. I'm the first to say it, how lucky I was, but he kind of lived his career through me, and I loved every minute of it. He wasn't a sort of a helicopter dad. That he was the guy that if you saw a guy sitting way off to the side that didn't say one word, that you never knew who he was, but he always came to the game, that was my father. You know, and really, when I moved up in levels and started playing at older age groups with Tab Ramos, it was Tab's dad and my dad that sat because there were only two that didn't speak English in our town that were going to games. So they became really, really close friends, you know, and they loved it. You know, they loved everything. Just a big grin on their face all the time. This was like their pride and joy, you know, it was pretty cool.
One of the things that I always think about with your group, both, you know, qualifying for 90, playing in the 90 World Cup, the Youth World Cup you mentioned, as well as you didn't have streaming, you didn't have cable the same, you weren't going over to play tournaments at Manchester United. Like, when you stepped into the 1990 World Cup as a group of basically college kids, did you know what you were going up against? Did you? Everyone says now, yeah, we believed in ourselves, but at the time, what was the conversations like stepping into those stages?
You know, Bob Gansler, Ralph Perez, Joe Macnick, those were our coach. That was our coaching staff, and they did everything they could to find video, get a look at Czechoslovakia at the time. And I can remember, we joke about this when we get together. You know, they said, "Oh, they're not very big, they're not very fast." We watched them against Germany at that point, and Germany just—I mean. Completely ripped them apart. And I thought, you know, thinking about it now, like, that's the worst thing you could have done, right? I was watching against Germany. And then you get in the tunnel, and I could remember John Doyle was our biggest guy. He was probably outside of the little number 11, the forward that they had. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but John Doyle was the second smallest guy in that team. And I thought to myself, we're in a lot of trouble, man. But, you know, we were so young. We were so naive. We were so ambitious to do well. But I don't think that we were nervous in any way, just because we were that naive. We were that naive to the World Cup and who we were in the world. We just thought, we were supposed to qualify. Who cares what happened for 40 years before that? You know, that's not what we came here to do. We came here to qualify. And clearly we needed to improve, right? We were not a great team, although I thought we got better as the tournament went on. We had some good stretches against Italy, which we almost made things happen there, at least almost got a result there. That was fun. You know, and really, though, that team was set up for 1994, right? It was kind of like I still think our national team now is really set up for 2026.
So take me back before that tournament. You won the job. You were there for the shot heard round of the world. What was that team like? What was the pressure like, if there was any? Take me inside that locker room and inside that group.
Well, the pressure was really, man, if we qualify. Now, I had college to go back to. A lot of guys didn't. Myself, Chris Henderson, I'm trying to think, Eric Winalda. There may have been a couple others along, Marcelo Balboa, maybe. He was at San Diego State, I think. Some of us had college to go back to. The pressure was not if we don't qualify. The pressure is John Stollmeyer, who's working in the medical field, and Jimmy Banks, who unfortunately just passed away, who's trying to make his way in Milwaukee in soccer, and Jimmy Gabara, who didn't know what he was going to do. The pressure was, what if we do qualify? What am I going to do with my job?
Oh.
Like, how am I going to make a living doing this? That was real pressure. You know, that was... If we qualify for the World Cup, how do I make it? You know, how do I make it to make money to do all the trainings in January and February in order to get to June without losing my job at home, you know? And people, when I hear pressure now and when I hear people say, you know, MLS needs to do this right and they need to do that right. And the national team stinks because they don't do this. And I'm thinking to myself, boy, if these people had any idea what it looked like in 1989, if I'm not mistaken, we had one sponsor in 1989 that was $75,000 sponsor. That was the only paid sponsor, and that was Budweiser. Think about it. For all our youth national teams, how they did it, I have no idea.
When you talk about that group, one of the interesting things is a lot of people went on to a contract with U.S. Soccer and then got loaned out to clubs but came back in going into the 94 World Cup. I believe you lived in a dorm together and trained. What was that atmosphere like around that group? Because it seems like a dream. You're representing the U.S. It's like a college team.
Yeah, so we actually, around, I think it was January 1993, we moved to Mission Viejo. They decided that, and I was just coming back from France. I had a contract I signed in December in a small club that was at the top of the second division called Istres, which is in the south east part of France on the water, and they were looking at promotion.
Not a bad place to be, huh?
But then they showed me what Mission Viejo looked like, and I was like, that's not a bad place to be either. that's not too bad. And they actually, after a short period of time, they moved us into apartments, and yeah, we essentially lived as a club team. But remember, we still had John Harkes, who was playing in Europe, Tab, Casey Keller at the time. There were a whole bunch of guys. Ernie Stewart was getting in that group. You know, so we had to integrate those guys in whenever we could. And I don't know that international windows were the same back then as they are now, where you got, you know. So we didn't see a lot of those guys until just prior to the World Cup. But I still say that anyone who survived 2 years of Bora Milutinovic in Mission Viejo can survive anywhere. You know, it was just grueling every single day.
Best Bora story, please. Please take us behind that grueling atmosphere, whether it be the way he coached, the drills he ran, the culture.
Well, he ran one drill. That was it. One player, one ball. That's what we did for an hour before every training. And you can ask anyone from that team, what's the drill that Bora did? It's one player, one ball. And you had two goals, and you just dribbled up and down, and you played a give and go with him, or you played a give and go with Timo Lukowski, who was our assistant coach, or Steve Sampson, who was the other one. You shot on goal, and after a while, everyone's shooting the ball over the goal because they're like, oh, this thing's, we're an hour into this thing right now, you know? So I'm going to chase the ball for a little while.
Wait, you're chasing your own balls?
Yeah, well, we didn't have. Who's going to chase him?
It's a good point. I mean, you just imagine somebody.
See that, or training's over after
invite
that.
A couple kids out there and just be like, guys, you know.
No, we didn't have it. We were bare bones, although they did a really good job. Nice little training facility in Mission Viejo, and we made the best of it. We played a lot of international games. Bora played everybody at that time, beating Germany, Brazil, Romania at the time. It was a World Cup qualifier, and we played Colombia, I think, like six times in two and a half years. I mean, he wanted to play everybody we could, because as he explained it to me, and I saw him at this summer at the World Cup, as he explained it, he didn't want the World Cup to be a shock. You know, he didn't want us to play Brazil in the World Cup for the first time, where you're like, oh man, you know, we didn't know then. We were just playing everybody.
How does being in such close proximity for so long on the brink of a life-changing experience change the relationships between those guys? You said you were just at a 94 reunion. I mean, that is the team, and I know every World Cup means so much, and those teams are all bonded in a certain way, but in the U.S., the second one, the time where you could actually make a jumping point and you spend all that time together, I have to imagine it's super tight-knit.
Yeah, you remember all of those moments, all those crazy moments, right, that happened in a locker room, that happened, you know, at a restaurant, on a bus, on an airplane, traveling, you know, when the pilot misjudges the landing by 4 feet when you land in Ecuador, you know, that it might have been the last time you were talking to each other, right? So you talk about all of those things, and it's a really good group of guys. I mean, I still think it's just a personal feeling. Take me out of the equation, because I've been pretty lucky to at least stay in the game for a little bit. I still think a lot of those guys don't get a lot of credit for what they did in that group, and more so even 1990. It's sad that, you know, Jimmy Banks passed away, unfortunately, a couple weeks ago, and what a great human being that I hope soccer fans know. I hope they have an idea now who Jimmy Banks was, because I'm not quite sure. We didn't come in the social media era. There was no blanket Twitter coverage here. Yeah, and I just hope that guys like him, guys like Mike Windishman, who was the captain of the team, I wonder if you asked the staunchest soccer fan, you know, if you asked 10 of them, how many would know Mike Windishman was the captain of that team, you know, and what he did. And David Vanoli, who unfortunately passed away years ago, was, you know, the guy that and I tell the story all the time, this guy taught me how to be a teammate, you know, taught me everything I knew about how to be a teammate, because he could have said, this punk from New Jersey, I'm going to make it miserable on him. And I was a punk. I was a 19-year-old punk. Like, I didn't care who I was playing. And he could have made the day miserable every day. But he chose to make it that I got better every day while he's still trying to fight for a job, right? So that taught me at 19 years old how to be a teammate. And I took that throughout my career. All the guys that I've ever worked with, from Tim Howard, DeBo, Shawnee, all the guys that I had for a long period of time, I think will tell you that our working relationship was always great. And I learned it when I was 19, which you don't learn a lot of lessons at 19.
You were a punk. What kind of punk?
Yeah, I mean, I was a kid from New Jersey. I fought my way out of Kearney,
New
Jersey.
That's all you had to say. We got it.
You got it? Yeah, it was, you know, I wouldn't take crap from anybody, you know, I was going to fight for every minute on the field I could, and I didn't care how I was going to do it. You know, and I came in an era where Casey Keller came up. Just shortly after that, Brad Friedel came up. There was Jürgen Sommer in there. There were a lot of really talented goalkeepers, so you always had to be at the top of your game all the time because someone, just like I was waiting to take David Vanoli's spot every moment I could or Jeff Dubek's spot, they were trying to. We were all trying to do the same thing.
Who's the best goalkeeper you've ever worked with besides yourself?
No. You mean in what way?
Like whether opponents or in training goalkeepers that you saw?
I think Timmy, and that's not a slight on Casey or Brad. I didn't work with them. Maybe I worked with Brad as long as Timmy because we were in Mission Viejo together. Brad served one of the best balls you could serve. It was great. Great to train that way. Yeah. And he pushed every day. And he's a real fitness guy. He was always fit. And he made it. You know, that wasn't my strong suit, you know, back then. And he made it difficult every day. And I shouldn't say difficult. Made it better every day in order to train harder. But Timmy was the most wide-eyed, wanting to learn all the time, always asking questions, and we were always throwing things off of each other. And Tim Mulqueen, who's now coaching in the USL, was our goalkeeper coach. So three Jersey guys every day, going from training to the pizza parlor to the ice cream shop, back to training the next day. It was a good working relationship. I think we both learned a lot from each other at that point.
You've alluded to some of the differences in the world, in the sporting world, between when you played and now, and taking out the it was always better in my day factor, because that's always natural. What are the parts of 2019 American soccer and social media do you think are better or worse, or that you would have enjoyed now, or you preferred it when you were playing?
I don't know that I would have enjoyed social media. I don't know that it would have been I would have been the guy after a game that would have been on social media talking about the game or an opponent or a call or something. I don't know. I struggle now when I don't have to worry about those things. I can't imagine what the players go through, because I feel like sometimes when they open up and try to be honest, you know, they get hammered for it. When they don't play well, they get hammered for it. I could see myself showing up at someone's doorstep, you know, and going, did you really tweet that about me? You know, but it just that part of it, I think, is difficult for it's difficult to manage. Some guys do a really good job with it. And I think it's great to continue to grow your brand. Everyone's growing. I didn't care about brand. Like, I didn't care. You know, people talked about my hair back then, right? I didn't really care. That's the haircut I wanted. I didn't think, like, that it would be. I didn't think in 1995, when I cut my hair, that my endorsements would go through the floor. Like, that's.
Did they?
They
Is that
did.
A thing that happened?
They did. They did. Yeah. Yeah. Because it was so recognizable with hair. But I didn't think that way. No one told me that. Social media didn't make a big deal about someone's hair. They make more of a big deal about it now and all those haircuts than they did back then. But that's not how I thought. Now players have to think that way, right? They have to, because that's what the society is telling you. And so that part of it, I think, would be difficult. What I do love about I wish we had is sort of the technology that's on the field. That part, how to keep yourself fit. And I was lucky. I played till I was 39, so it's not as if I, you know, lost any years out of it. But I still think you always go back, Bobby, and you think, like, I could have been better here, you know, and I could have been better there. I wish I had. I think I would have been better if all those things were available to me, but they weren't, so we didn't know about them. But that part, I really wish was part of the game when I was playing.
I sometimes think about those years before MLS arrived as kind of a soccer purgatory, where you're talking about guys are just trying to find opportunities wherever they can. And you played indoor after that 94 World Cup. You went all over. What was that period like of sort of waiting for the league to come, trying to get the best opportunities you could? Where were you in that time?
Well, again, we were all trying to make a living, first of all, right? And I can remember when I first got the call in Buffalo, my first thought about playing indoor was I can get better with my feet, because the game had changed. I remember I grew up in a day where you can bounce the ball and take four more steps and roll the ball, you know, and take four more steps. That doesn't exist now. Now they're going to change the rules, and they changed them in, I think, 1993, 92 or 93. I can't remember. So in 94, we had that rule to play with, and I had to find a way to get better, and this winter opportunity came where I lived in New Jersey, right? You can't go outside and train and do all that. We weren't getting together with the national team, and I had this opportunity to go, and then all of a sudden they were like, okay, well, you know, remember, this is 1995. They're like, well, pay you $6,000 a game. And they're like, we have four games next week. You know, because indoor you play like Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I'm talking to my wife. I'm like, I never played indoor before, but hell, you know, this is pretty good.
Yeah.
So I went. The first game was in Dayton, Ohio, in an indoor facility, and the place is packed. And now I get a call the next night from the league, and they're like, can you stick around for another month? And I'm like,
I was going to say, we were in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. You came to the farm show complex with
that's
Buffalo.
That's right. With all
it
the
sold the place out. That's right.
Yeah, all the cows were they were doing something. What was it? It was like a cow show.
Listen, you don't worry about what we do in central Pennsylvania, okay? But no, we were one of those communities where you came. You were Tony Miola coming, and it was a big event. My whole team went. My family went. Myself, my
it
older brothers.
It was sold out in Harrisburg. Everywhere we went was sold out.
We were ecstatic to come see you play.
Yeah, and the league called me, and the first – so we played two away games before the first home game. So you played Friday and Saturday night away, and then Sunday afternoon we came back to Buffalo. And believe me, these guys talking about charter flights. We weren't chartering flights. We could tell you that much. And we came back, and all of a sudden we went in the arena, and it was completely packed, 18,000 people. And the league called me and said, can you stay for another month? I'm like, oh, at that price, I could stay as long as you want, you know, jokingly. And I thought to myself, this is really helping me. And then we had to get ready for MLS season the following year. So that's kind of when I ended in February. But, yeah, I took a lot of steps. You know what? I said to myself, I don't want to I don't necessarily want to have to say when I'm 60, I'm 50 now, right? So I'm not too far away, but I'm saying 15 years ago, I don't want to have to say I wish I did this, you know, when I'm 60 years old, when I had the chance when I was 30 years old to do it, you know, and I don't regret very much of that stuff at all. I mean, I did a lot of things. I don't regret any of it.
When you look at that time period, you mentioned MLS coming up. What was the conversation like with the group of guys who clearly were national team level or borderline that were going to be a part of whatever was coming up in 96?
Yeah, there was a period of time, if you remember, after 94, we were supposed to start in 95. And that's where this whole acting thing came in that you were talking about.
Yeah, the Jets too.
Yeah, the Jets right after the World Cup, because I wasn't going to Europe. What the plan was they had told us that a couple of us were going to be, I forget what they called it. We weren't designated players, but they had four guys on every team.
Allocation
players, is that what they were? There's so many different.
The inaugural allocations,
there you
I believe
go.
Is what it was called.
Okay, so we were going to be allocated players, and in January we were going to start getting paid, and we were going to do promotions, and we were going to go around and promote the league, and then they would tell us what they would tell everyone what team you would be on, and that's – so there were a series of announcements that were going to happen. So I said, I'm going to stay in the U.S. and, you know, I'm going to help the league and I'm going to be part of the league. And then we got the decision that the league wasn't going to start until 1996. And now it was like, what am I going to do? And one of our dear friends, I contacted Alfonso Mondello, and he was coaching the Long Island Rough Riders at the time. And it was all the guys that I had grew up playing with on the regional team. And we put a great team together that won a USISL championship with Alfonso, who was outstanding. He was a great guy to play for. I played for him also in New York Metro Stars for a short period of time. And that's how I got to I bridged the gap from 94 to 96.
Now also my turn, by the way. I went to those games.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I'm from Long Island, and we used to go to those Rough Riders
games. I'm not
games.
Feeling any younger during no. this conversation.
But you guys were awesome, and it was a huge deal for us to go to those.
Yeah,
what cool. role did you play in this? It was off-Broadway, right? I mean, what was – I need
it
to know.
Tony and Tina's wedding.
It's the one where everyone eats, right?
You go to a church, Tony and Tina get married,
yep.
and you're part – so the guests are part of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then you proceed, I think – down Bleecker Street, cross 6th Avenue, if I have my geography.
I think it's still on.
It is. It's still the longest running off-Broadway show ever in off-Broadway history. And we'd walk there, and you walk to this reception hall, and you have a reception. And then a whole bunch of things go wrong with an Italian wedding. And so I played the part of Tony. So it wasn't much of a stretch, but it was fun. I did it. You know, I was an acting and television major at the University of Virginia, so I had to convince my parents that 2.5 years weren't completely wasted. So that's what I did.
Could you kick a football? Think you could have made a run with it?
Yeah, you know, I didn't get a great opportunity to be a field goal kicker because Nick Lowry was there at the time, one of the all-time best kickers in the NFL. So I was his kickoff guy. You know, and then when Tony Casillas, a player that was in Dallas, you know, they made the trade. They got rid of the six guys in the practice squad. I got to tell you, it was cool. I did it. I signed an NFL contract. It was the most boring job you could ever have. I honestly got 8:05 meetings in the morning. 8 o'clock to 8:05 was your team meeting. Everyone breaks up into individual meetings. There's two kickers in a room with a coach. That coach went on to win a whole bunch of Super Bowls in New England. Brad Seeley, as a special teams coach, went on to win there. Pete Carroll was my head coach, who I stayed friends with since. And we didn't do anything until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I watched, I lifted and I watched all kinds of crazy talk shows. That was it all day.
My dad can't watch this interview now because he gets really upset about the Pete Carroll years of the New York Jets.
I guess
is the better way to put it.
We got to get you out of here pretty quick, but I need to know your best MLS memory. What's the thing that stands out? Is it, we talked about 2000. 2000 was such an incredible year for you and the Kansas City Wizards. What's the memory that you really lean on and think about often?
How Kansas City kind of changed my life, really. You know, 2000 is the year that everyone remembers, right? That's, we won a championship. I won a bunch of trophies, and that was great. But it changed my life in a way that I was open to change because I was not going to Kansas City when I got traded, not at all. And my wife said, you know, why don't we give it a shot? You know, like, let's give it a shot. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to Kansas City. That's it. I'm done.
You sound like my fiance right now.
Yeah. And I realized had I not got traded back to MetroStars/Red Bulls, it changed that year when I got there. I would have stayed I probably would be living in Kansas City right now. And I learned then that change is okay. It was a time in the league where you weren't changing all the time. You know, I couldn't figure out how this New Jersey kid was being asked to leave New Jersey. Like, it didn't make sense to me. And that's just the truth. I didn't like the way it went down. We had a meeting with Bora and my dear friend now, Charlie Stilettano, who was the GM there. And they brought us in a room. And they said, okay, we're going to have individual meetings. You guys are going to watch Rocky V. That's what they did. They put us in a room to show us how you fight and you know, overcome adversity. And one by one, they picked us off in a room and they went in there and they said, look, you're face of the organization and we're not going to trade you. And yeah, I was ticked off that Peter Vermes had gotten traded the year before. And then I got in my car. I drove from Giant Stadium near the offices were there, Sea Caucus. And I was driving home a half hour, and I heard on the radio that I got traded.
Whoa.
Literally, when I got in my car, and I was not happy about it. And not happy about the trade, not happy about the way it went down, because it didn't make sense to me. But I realized being in Kansas City that change in your life could be good. And, you know, we made it. You know, we've a bunch of misfits, we called ourselves in Kansas City, because a lot of guys that weren't wanted at other places, we won a championship.
An incredible career, Tony Meola. Thanks for joining us. Before we let you go, though, National Soccer Hall of Fame, another induction class coming up this year. I was so excited and happy to be able to vote in that. What does it mean to you to be a part of this Hall of Fame? How does it kind of crop up in your life?
Oh, you know, daily it comes up. I mean, I didn't play to be in a Hall of Fame. I played because I loved the game. And to think that something I loved from the time I was 6 years old to make it to the Hall of Fame in your sport is really cool. And I certainly appreciate it more every single day. because now I know when I voted this year as well, and I know how difficult it is, and I know the feeling, and I remember the phone call from Hank Steinbrecher saying, you made it, you know, and I was, first time in my life, I was speechless, you know, and yeah, it's really special. It really is.
Is there someone out there that you think deserves to be in the Hall of Fame that isn't? That you think about and say, oh, just missed on that one. Or somebody on the ballot this year that you thought, this person has to get in and I'm just not sure they will? Because that's kind of the story of it sometimes.
Yeah. Joe Max Moore is a guy to me that probably didn't get enough credit for what he did. Probably because when soccer was over, he left soccer, you know, and went on to do a lot of great things in business and is doing really, really well. But he's a guy that I would think at some point should be in.
Tony, thank you so much.
Thanks,
for braving an hour
it.
And a half of traffic in New Jersey, coming all the way
it.
Here. You're the precursor for more trips to the AT&T MLS studios. We're going to get out of here. Enjoy your Memorial Day, everybody. We will see you on Thursday. We'll be right back.